Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, everyone. This is the Direction for Truth show for May 20th, 2014, with Richard Talk to Me Guy. And today, Sherry Edwards is off running around like a mad, I bet, getting ready for a conference that starts tomorrow, the Human Bioacoustics Annual Conference at the actual world headquarters of Sound Health Options in Ohio. 4 days of, boy, I can only imagine talking sound, talking amazing things and results and stuff and meetings and wow, I think it'd be very cool. But I couldn't quite fit it in. And also on Saturday, they're having the world premiere of the Business of Disease, which is a film which has been worked on for about 3 years, I believe, almost more than that now, with everybody from Bruce Lipton, I believe Perlmutter, maybe Tom O'Brien. I can't remember some of the other names. I don't have the promotional piece in front of me. And also our very own Sherry Edwards, talking about business of disease. As I like to say, follow the money. So Sherry may be popping in, but I think she's pretty darn busy getting ready for conference because it's actually, as I say, it's at the actual headquarters. So they have all sorts of meetings and activities planned. So we will get right into it. I don't have other announcements other than ongoing annoyance, although I did hear something really good about fracking in California. I heard that Santa Cruz is trying to pass a local county ordinance banning fracking in Santa Cruz.
Yay.
So, exactly. Yay. I'm so excited. Let's do it that way. If we have to just do it by county, let's just take a stand and say no. We may want to, you know, use that water someday.
Yeah. Now.
And on that note, now would be good, especially since we seem to be in California, for those of us in California, and our guest, Polly Halstead, is in California as well. We're already, some people say we're moving into, I'm already saying we're in drought conditions because we didn't have enough rain this winter. So, yeah, let's not frack anything up. So, Polly Halstead wrote this really wonderful cookbook. You know, we call it simply a cookbook, but it's really a lifestyle, in my mind, my view, called Primal Cuisine, Cooking for the Paleo Diet. It's a book that is really more of a compendium to Primal Body, Primal Mind by Nora Gagaudis, which explains why the primal diet of our ancestors is the most successful from an evolutionary standpoint and the diet that we will thrive on today. Eliminating grains and focusing on protein and good fats is the key to the paleo diet. The delicious recipe in Polly's Primal Cuisine will help anyone with dietary issues such as obesity, diabetes, celiac disease, hypersensitivity to gluten, hypoglycemia, ADD, ADHD, and many forms of depression. To turn the tide of illness, which are the result of the Western diet, and take responsibility for our own health, we must change the way we eat. Welcome, Polly.
Hey, glad to be back, Richard.
Glad to have you. So I guess for listeners that don't know you, I have to ask that opening question. How did you, because I know that, let's see, for other listeners who don't know me or aren't familiar, I was in the food world for almost 20 years myself as a chef. So I'm so curious, knowing that you were in the catering business for almost 20 years, actually a little, northeast, in the Napa County area for almost 20 years. How did you get from being a regular culinary person to writing a book about the paleo diet?
Well, it's a little bit of a long story, but I'll shorten it. Even though I opened my first restaurant in 1975 in San Francisco, and then eventually moved to the Napa Valley and catered during the 80s and 90s. you know, I was cooking fabulous food, but I wasn't very healthy. I was addicted to sugar. I didn't know I had a lot of food intolerances, things like that. And so I was plagued with a number of health problems, you know, most of my adult life. My mother had a severe mental illness. I had lots of depression. And fast forward, I eventually wound up at a spiritual retreat center in Hood River, Oregon, beginning in 2007. And even though I was meditating and doing all these seemingly healthy things, became a vegetarian up there sort of under duress, I was still depressed. I mean, isn't that funny? But I had the good fortune one day, someone handed me Nora Gadgadis' book. She had just come out with Primal Body, Primal Mind. And I started reading it, and it just made profound sense to me that it was our original diet that we evolved on as humans, and we were very healthy then, you know, and in order to regain that health, we had to go back to that basic way of eating. And in the back of her book, she had a couple pages on this genetic disorder, pyroluria, which was one of the causes of schizophrenia, and I had a lot of the symptoms of that. So Nora lived in Portland, and I called her up, and I said, I think I need to come and see you, which I did, and I became her client. So she had me tested for all kinds of things and put me on the paleo diet. That's how I got started. And so I began to wean myself off grains and sugars. Had about 3 months of horrible withdrawal from those things. And after about 3 months, my depression went away. You know, I hadn't taken any medications for a number of years because I didn't feel like help. But all of a sudden, the brain fog, the depression lifted. It has never come back. And so that was a real clue for me that things were changing, and it's been getting incrementally better. My energy came back. All kinds of things that had plagued me before cleared up. It was just a whole new life after that.
Wow. Now, had you when you'd been cooking, had you had a lean, especially because since I live, you know, south, just slightly south, or in the same area that you cooked in for so many years, I know what we have, what amazing, you know, kinds of quality food we have in our area that's grown and harvested and raised and everything here. Had you, during your years of catering, I knew that the restaurant you'd had in San Francisco was vegetarian. My point is that had you always leaned toward cooking clean, organic?
No, that my restaurant in the city wasn't a vegetarian. Basically,
sorry.
I was into California-style cuisine, farmer's market, really good fish, all the stuff that we you know, normally are used to in the wine country. Really high quality. I was really into breads. I got breads from Della Fattoria. I'd drive to Berkeley and get Acme bread and Semifreddy bread before, you know, it got delivered up there. So I was into quality. But what I didn't realize, you know, I had a lot of food sensitivities. I think I was, you know, I had gluten intolerance. I didn't even know it. So, and casein intolerance. So even though, you know, I was cooking a lot of organic farmers market type stuff, I still had a lot of these food intolerances that I was unaware of. And so they were, I believe, the root cause of a lot of my physical and mental problems.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the point I was working toward was we all know people. I'll just talk to me. I know people around me that eat, you know, really, they only eat organic. They only eat everything, you know, a lot of locavore, you know, people who only get foods that are locally grown, locally harvested. They're all organic. They've never seen a pesticide other than, you know, flyby. But I mean, you know, they eat incredibly clean diets, but they don't get the leap of exactly what you discovered, is that just
right.
because you're eating this amazingly clean, beautiful food from the amazing wine country of Central California, Northern California, that you can still have food intolerances, food allergies, issues, even if you're eating the most amazing organic Delafatoria, I love their bread, ever.
Food intolerances now, I believe, are epidemic in the U.S. for a number of reasons, which, you know, as we talk along, we'll find out. But what I learned later on via Nora are there are 24 foods that your body may mistake for gluten, you know, like a lot of the gluten-free grains and stuff like that. It could be coffee, eggs. For me, it was eggs. So when you eat these things, your body is reading it like it's gluten, and you start to have a reaction to it. So I've learned to tell people, and I've subsequently gotten tested myself via Intero Lab and Cyrex Lab to find out exactly what my food intolerances are so I can avoid them. And you really need to cut to the chase if you're having a lot of symptoms and find out.
Yeah, and actually discover there is, I'll interject that actually this last weekend, Sherry taught a class called Allergies Class. And it's using her technology of vocal profiling, where you use the vocal print and you run it through this program that's looking at allergies. And it gives similar to, you know, actually interesting to put it side by side. It isn't looking at the blood, or, you know, in the way that you're doing when you're doing those kinds of Enterolab type testing. However, it is showing people that they have tendencies or inclinations toward particular foods. And you can even use the simple program called NanoVoice to test your voice, then eat the food, and then wait 20 minutes, and then test your voice again and see what the shift is in your vocal profile. And it'll give you indications of you having a reaction or not.
That's
so,
really,
I mean, there are powerful
tools. It's kind of like
tools.
Muscle testing, but with the voice box.
well, the part that it eliminates is, in terms of the muscle testing, is that it's software analyzed. So there
isn't
is no,
something?
There is no, you know, with muscle testing, even though I've known a few practitioners that are very skilled at kinesiology who can test clearly, that's real hard to get what I would call a clear read doing muscle testing.
I could never do it myself. I mean,
right, exactly. I used to test myself on things, and it was like, you know, I could find myself lying to myself. Well, that's what I love about the vocal profiling is you can't lie because you can't lie. I've tried.
Yeah.
I've tried
that
doing
sometimes.
Things to Sherry. And
oh, really?
So it's really
that's,
interesting.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So there is that, you know, that's a powerful tool that people can have access to. I would still, as what you're saying, is I would still think that going and having blood work done at least is a foundational thing, to know what you have as a foundation. And then as you go along the path, also add in using the vocal profiling, either allergy testing program or the NanoVoice program, to be able to monitor you on a short-term basis. It's a powerful combination. Because to know, you know, to really exactly what you're talking about is to know that here are the things, and once you found out those tests, did you eliminate them all and start over, or did you eliminate slowly, or how did you withdraw from all that?
I pretty much have eliminated gluten from my life, you know, except for very rare occasions. But I've mostly really cut out a lot of dairy. I switched over to sheep and goat's milk stuff, but I've eliminated cow. I hardly eat eggs anymore because that was what I was most cross-reactive with, and I never did eat soy anyway. So those were my main ones.
And do you test? I haven't had that kind of blood work done, but I'm familiar with it, sort of. When you were tested, do they show issues with sugar, or is that mostly having to do with reactions in terms of cortisol levels and blood sugar levels?
Yeah, it doesn't have that much to do with sugars, as far as the Cyrex lab one.
Okay.
But, you know, when Nora tested me, I was hypoglycemia. Going on the paleo diet cleared up the hypoglycemia because I was eating, you know, less carbs and sugars and more fats. You know, adding the nutritious fats in really helped a whole lot, amazingly enough.
I know, it's a shocking thing. I think I read this off your website or off the book. Talk to us for a minute about the big fat lie.
It's changing now, but for decades we were sold this thing like cholesterol was really bad for us. Don't eat egg yolks. Don't eat butter or cream or, only eat lean meats, cut the fat off the meat and stuff like that. Now they have found that our body and our heart and our nerve endings actually need the good cholesterol. And when I'm talking about animal fats, I'm talking about the fats from animals that have been exclusively grass-fed. Because when animals eat, those GMO toxic grain-fed products, then the fat retains the toxin. So it's really important that the fats that you eat don't have the toxins in them.
And what are your favorite fats? That's more of a personal question, but it just came out. I just thought of it.
I've been cooking a lot with ghee because you have the casein taken out of it, plus then you can saute with it. So I use ghee every day in my cooking, coconut oil, olive oil, avocado oil, and I'm not eating too many eggs once in a while. But when you eat the grass-fed meat, like the other night we had these great grass-fed ribeye steaks, and the fat on those steaks are just incredibly good. So you just eat the fat right along with it. That's what our ancestors did. Their diet was probably 50% fat, and they were lean. So,
isn't it amazing? I know. Fat got such a bad rap around the era of the Kellogg's. I'm only using his name because it's a good reference point, and I think about the film. That was that whole, I remember I was studying with Crispin Sullivan, who is a nutritionist in Marin County, and we talked about that. This was in the, a long time ago, the 80s. And we would sit around and talk about the articles in the magazines and just watching the just pumping up of the carbohydrate revolution.
Everything
was about carbs. That we swung the complete opposite direction, moving toward carbs were our friend, carbs were your fool. There was Pritikin diet? Was he the one that had you had to eat a loaf of bread a day, a loaf of French bread a day, or was that somebody else? There was somebody that had you eating, like, tremendous amounts of carbs, and one of them eat a baguette a day, which just when I think about what I know about gluten now, it's like, oh, my God. Oh, no wonder you're so thin. Your gut is, like, screaming, like, help me.
And then what happened? Everybody became fat and obese, because, they had all the skim milk and all the low-fat yogurt and all this stuff, but what happened? They were eating all the carbs and sugars and it became fat.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
And the ever deadly margarine, the margarine revolution. Where we took away,
mother.
You know, the
mine
too. Yeah,
oh,
we had big
God.
Tubs of that nasty stuff, and I always thought, even as a kid, I thought, this doesn't seem
it was
normal.
Like spreading plastic on your bread. And my grandparents would come to visit. When my grandparents came to visit, of course they had real butter and cream. So I always loved them to visit because we got to have real butter and real cream.
Yeah, because they had no idea what margarine was. They thought margarine was just as creepy. Like, why would you do that? Why would you dump out the cream? Why have you got low-fat milk? I want cream in my coffee. Damn it.
Yeah.
I know, exactly.
I know. The thing I hate most is to go visit people who still have 2% milk in their refrigerator to put in your coffee in this morning.
Yes.
I just want to kill them.
I do too. Really, you're putting pink milk in there. You have this amazing organic local you know, fair trade coffee and you're putting 2% pink milk in it? Really?
No, really. Oh, God.
I know. It's a rant of mine. Obviously, I'm happy to jump on that bandwagon because it's just like, I love a good cup of coffee and I just hate that when it's like, oh, would you like pink milk? No.
Really?
No, I would not like pink milk. And how do you find, back to the goat and sheep cheese, do you find, because you were casein intolerant, do you find that that's that you work okay with that now? That's more of a personal question for me because that's the swing I've gone.
Yeah, I seem to be fine. Although lately I have cut back on cheese in general, I seem to be fine with it. Everybody's a little bit different, so you just have to go with what your body can do.
Right. I'm not sure if it, in regards to goat cheese, I'm not sure if part of the benefit, to me, at least to me in my mind, is that goats are out eating grass is a normal thing. They're not really feed animals. They're sort of field animals. They're not kept in pens because they can eat anything. actually, there's somebody around here.
Yeah, I think they are still eating grass.
Yeah, exactly. So actually, there's near here is a big racetrack. Used to be called Sears Race Point. Now it's called something else.
Oh, yeah.
And this time of year, they have the sheep. They bring the sheep in, and they have – so you'll be driving along, and all of a sudden you see, like, what looks to be a million sheep, and it's a lot of sheep. But they pen them off, and they mow the lawn. I mean, that's how they mow the lawn. They don't use power mowers.
Good.
They bring the goats in. They pen them for a couple of days in one area. Then they move them to another area to clear another hill. And I think it's just so wonderful. It's a great, you know, it's fulfilling. It's beneficial to everybody. And there's no pollution, you know. So I'm very pro goat cheese.
You know, I still drive around California. There's still just a lot of area where there's tons of grass. I'm wondering, why don't we have more cows out there? Eating it.
I don't know. That's a different
them
show.
We all into that feedlot down on Interstate 5, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's just, I think it's just, I know some dairymen, you know, well enough to, they'll give me grief later. But I think as part of it is it's that factory concept where the idea is that it's much easier to control an animal if they're in a pen or a cage or a thing where they're not just out wandering around. I don't know.
I don't know either.
Not my. We'll move to another. Now we're going to move into a tricky category, and I'm going to start at sort of a back way. I'm going to ask you to tell us what gut dysbiosis is, and that will lead into the big fist pounding conversation about glyphosate.
Okay. Well, dysbiosis means imbalance. So In your gut, you have either pathogenic bacteria or you have healthy bacteria. And the job of the healthy bacteria, which is what we evolved on, our ancestors had healthy bacteria because they were eating that particular diet. But as we first of all began to eat grains and then during the Industrial Revolution, more processed foods, and now God knows we're eating. Our guts are just full of pathogenic bacteria, and that they kill off the healthy bacteria, and then we are not able to digest our food. Like our healthy bacteria help make the vitamins, some of the vitamins, they help pre-digest our food so it can be absorbed and everything. And if that's not working right, everything gets thrown off and our whole immune system gets thrown off. So it's an imbalance in our gut.
Okay, and that's really, you know, I mean, that's such a huge piece. I'm a big fan of the gut, and I'm a big fan in that it really is the foundation of our immune system. And I think that's why there is such a result of, you know, immunosuppressive issues. And somewhere up here in the thing I read about the hypersensitivity to gluten is really, you know, celiac disease. So many of these diseases seem like they're being derived from weak gut itis, I'll call it. And so this paper, this wonderful paper that you, well, wonderful in air quotes, paper you wrote about glyphosate Roundup, for the common name, is so powerful. You know, talk to us about Roundup. Feel free to rant. Take a shoe off. Pound on the table.
Okay. Well, you know, we see it every day on the news. Why is this spike happening in these autoimmune disorders, autism, brain problems, all that in the last couple of decades? Well, if you track it, it really goes along with the introduction of genetically modified foods, mostly grains, and the fact that they can now be heavily sprayed with this pesticide glyphosate. Now that glyphosate residue is on the foods that, you know, we are consuming that are not organic, and also the animal feed that is, most of our commercially raised animals are being fed. So the glyphosate is not washed off. It's staying in our food system, and the glyphosate apparently is causing inflammation in the gut. It's causing the gut to have like leaky gut syndrome. We're not able to digest the food anymore properly, nor are the farm animals either. They're very ill. That's why they give them antibiotics. So they're now saying that the glyphosate is causing this extreme gut dysbiosis and interfering with our whole food assimilation, so we're not getting the nutrients out of our food. We're now severely nutrient deprived because of this. Our whole food system is contaminated with this stuff. So it's really an insidious problem, and it's causing all kinds. Let me just read you this one little paragraph here. It says, gluten intolerance is an underdiagnosed but growing epidemic in the U.S., as is celiac disease, a much more dangerous autoimmune-like disorder to which many other diseases are now linked. Some of the symptoms of gluten intolerance and celiac disease are obesity, infertility, skin rashes, autism, Alzheimer's disease, schizophrenia, Parkinson's, thyroid disease, kidney disease, some cancers, including non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and melanoma, type 1 and type 2 diabetes, allergies, fibromyalgia, arthritis, panic attacks, and on brain problems. Does that sound familiar? I mean, it's like everybody in the U.S. who is eating our current, you know, prepackaged food and all that stuff, all the commercially raised meats, have some of these symptoms. It's rampant. And they're now tying it to the glyphosate.
Wouldn't it be fascinating to, this is almost like I should go on, we should go backstage for me to say this. Wouldn't it be fascinating to see the correlation between the amount of fast food consumption in America? I'm not picking anybody with arches or anything. But I mean, just the consumption of mass marketed fast foods and those animals, just the animals, not even the grains, and what the animals are eating that is, you know, just permeated the world, and particularly the U.S., to see the, you know, level of exposure that people have of glyphosate in their bodies would be just, I think, mind-blowing, in my opinion, because I like
that. Yeah, and it doesn't go away easily. Even if we, decide to go organic, It takes a long time for that stuff to be worked out of our fat cells. Like I said before, all these toxins are retained in fat cells. Over a period of time after going on the paleo diet, you know, you are slowly detoxifying from everything you ate before. But it takes time. And Monsanto has sold us a bill of goods, like glyphosate breaks down very fast in the soil and you know, on the plants and stuff. Well, it doesn't. Now they found out that it can stay in the soil from 7 to 22 years, and it seeps down into the water supply. So I can't say strongly enough, we really have to stop using this.
And do you see any, is there any reduction or hope of reduction? I mean, it's the usual, like, spin. I remember as a kid I grew up around the Salinas Valley, and I remember driving through the Salinas Valley on the way up to Palo Alto to visit my grandparents, and how fun it was to stick my head out of the car and be sprayed by the crop dusters.
Oh, no.
So I would act, because it was so, you know, I mean, there you're driving through, you know, the Salinas Valley, and the crop dusters are flying over. I mean,
we had crop dusters flying over our house when I grew up in Coalinga, California, right over the house. There was a cotton field across the street.
Oh, my God, cotton. Wow. So dusted with DDT, which they made all the claims and spun the story and the thing, and, you know, it took years to stop. And, I mean, it's the same thing in the water table and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And now here we are with, you know, phase two DDT. You know, it's not really DDT, but now it's Roundup. I mean, it's just like it blows my mind.
Well, Richard, I don't think it's going to be, they're going to stop using it anytime soon. I sent my article all over the place to Michelle Obama, to Governor Brown, to Dianne Feinstein, all the major papers, everything. Didn't hear one word like, oh, gee, this is really interesting. Thank you for sending us this article. You know, we have to take matters in our own hands and not eat this food. I mean, that's my thing, is boycott all this stuff and don't eat it. I don't know. I can't say it strongly enough.
Well, that is the, you know, it is back to that pathway of, you know, how do we get them to pay attention? We, you know, take away their money. And if that's what it takes, I mean, yes, I understand that you know, the other side of that coin is that people talk about how it's more expensive to shop, you know, organically, or how it's this. But the long-term effect of eating a healthy diet or a clean diet, organic or regionally or knowing, you know, I really love farmers markets because I like to go actually look the person in the eye that's making my food, growing my food. There's something very strong about that. It feels really good to have that relationship with the person who's growing your food.
Yeah, definitely. Well, people think, oh, it's expensive to buy organic. How expensive is it to have one of the list of symptoms or diseases I just read off? How expensive is that? You know, and not only the expense of it, but how you feel. Do you want to spend the rest of your life having one of those illnesses? I don't. I mean, for many, many years, I had a lot of symptoms. I didn't know why. Now I know, and I can do something about it.
Well, and we can take, you know, I mean, think about, I mean, I had, I had ADD as a kid. And, you know, please flash back to the scene in the movie where I'm sticking my head out the car like Opie, you know, getting dusted by a crop duster. And so to not only the impact of being healthier, but also just cleaning up your kids' diets so that they're not exposed to those things now, in the long term, the, you know, amount of health that we're creating by eating this way and beginning to act this way is going to have a shift on, you know, so many levels for so many people. It just seems like, you know, grow your own. Have a garden, you know, if you can. You don't need much space to have a garden to grow some kind of produce in your backyard and have, you know,
better
clean food.
I have a tiny area. I'm going to go plant my tomatoes this week. But, yeah, plant what you can, you know.
Plant what you can.
And definitely herbs and things out there.
Oh, absolutely. Now, I want to go back to your culinary career for a moment. When did GMOs enter your consciousness? I mean, in terms of, you obviously bought a lot from farmers markets and those all along because of the area you were in. When did you notice GMOs sort of becoming into the conversation?
In the last 10 years. I don't know.
Yeah.
I know they started to happen in the 90s, but I just wasn't, like I said, that paying attention to that right then. But I would say within the last decade, really.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's also, as I said, you know, when I was chefing, I mean, I had the people who started Earthbound Farms, because that was started on Monterey Peninsula in Carmel Valley. They were my original produce suppliers. They would come in. I knew the owners, and they'd supply produce.
Yeah.
So it didn't, in the same way that you did, we grew up in rarefied air in this part of California, where good, clean, organic food has been around for a really long time. And I'm not saying we're golden out here. I'm just saying, you know, it's sort of habitual for me. I mean, once you've cooked professionally and you've cooked with really great grown local product, it's hard to go to something commercial out of a truck that comes, you know, that pulls up and honks his big air horn.
Yeah, definitely.
So you get oriented.
Well, I tell you, when
way.
I moved to, when I lived up in Oregon for a while, we lived in that tiny town there. Oh, I was just not happy with the produce. It just wasn't what I was used to.
Yeah, and you were still, you know, on the Pacific Northwest. I mean, imagine what it's like if you're, you know, when I see, I mean, for instance, in the Salinas Valley, I think Salinas Valley is the largest producer of iceberg lettuce in the country. A, why? B, that there are some states that I've been to, even, you know, parts of Florida, where, you know, iceberg lettuce is a thing. Like, you serve it. I mean, now I
grew up on iceberg
lettuce.
What are you talking about,
too.
Richard?
Oh, no, no. Yeah, exactly. Me, too. Oh, no,
and
no.
I don't think I've had it since.
occasionally, I like an iceberg lettuce, a big wedge of iceberg lettuce.
With a wedge with some blue cheese.
Yeah,
dressing.
Yeah, crumbly blue cheese dressing, a creamy blue cheese dressing, absolutely. but, you know, beyond that, it's like, I don't even want it in my tacos. I don't want it anywhere in my, you know, just like, no, that's not anything. It's like fake. It's like the weirdest fake produce ever grown. But there is, you know, it's, I don't, you know, I'm happy to see in the food world this awareness happening on a certain level. I mean, even places like Costco are beginning to get in, you know, larger and larger sections of organic produce, and that's partially because they see that their people are demanding it. And
not
so that there
that,
is a trend.
I mean, I have, for the last two times I've been to Costco, gotten grass-fed fillets.
Wow.
Yeah, so I don't know. Things are starting to percolate here. And,
wow.
Yeah, stores like Trader Joe's and Costco are getting grass-fed stuff, so there is going to be more of a demand and an awareness.
Yeah, that's amazing. I know somebody who's working on a project for making, back to ghee for a moment, he's making a ghee, 50% ghee out of butter, and the other half is going to be made out of coconut oil, which is a wonderful combination.
It's fabulous. I do that here at home myself. Mix them.
Mix the two. Great flavor, good, you know, good cooking point. Oh, you know, wonderful on so many levels. And what he's running into is that to really mass produce it, that it's hard to find enough grass-fed butter for him to be able to do that, which is amazing to me. You know, really?
Yeah.
It's that hard. That's amazing.
I just, you know, wish those guys that raise those cows out there would really just switch over, you know.
Well, I know that there are some in our area. I can't remember who. It's not Clover. There's another one, somebody, but it's regional, although they're a national in distribution. They grow 80% of the time their cows are on grass, but during the winter months sometimes they have to. What they do is they harvest grass in the summer months, and then they put it into whatever those things are called, tall grain holders, they're called ones. And they then feed the grass. They never feed them grains is the bottom line. They go out of their way. Silos, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have the grass in silos so that their cows are getting grass year-round. Even if the grass is not fresh, it's still their grass that's grown out in the field.
Right.
And it's an amazing way to be thinking. And I hope that in the culinary world, I don't know if we've seen anything yet in the sort of more fast food realms. I see it at places like Chipotle. Now, I actually haven't been to a Chipotle, but I hear from friends that now Chipotle has started serving you know, had some organic birds and organic beans and rice. And, you know, so once you begin to see it beginning to trickle down, that's a really amazing thing.
But even
if it's, we're still back to this, you know, Roundup issue of it's, let's go back to talking about it, you know, how long does it last? Do we have a sense of how long it lasts in our water table? Has anybody been willing to say that, or we don't know?
It lasts in the soil now anywhere from, and they've measured this now, they know it's anywhere from 7 to 22 years. But what happens during that time is it'll trickle down and get into, you know, underground water. So, and I don't know how long it stays, you know, in the water. I guess it will stay in there as long as it keeps trickling down from above.
Yikes. Well, and again, you know, back to the Salinas Valley, I do mean to pick on them. I was going to say I don't. Yes, I do. They farmed so hard in the Salinas Valley that they actually they sucked so hard on the aquifer down there that they created something called saltwater intrusion, because that part of the valley goes all the way to the ocean. And so they suck so hard on the aquifer that they actually had saltwater intrusion into the water table, and that was why in the, I'll say the 80s, but I think it's late, earlier than that, they started doing experiments with shrimp, with mackerel genes in tomatoes. So what they were trying to do is they were trying to create a hybrid of a tomato that was more salt tolerant so that it could put up with the saline quality of the water table that had changed from when it was just pure water.
Wow.
So if we have that same thing going on, the amount of pesticides and chemistry that has gone on in that area blows my mind. And on top of that, we have something that's lasting, you know, between, I like this, that range of 7 to 20 years. Well, that's quite a range. That's, you know, all these large agricultural areas. And again, I keep picking on Salinas Valley because pretty much, I mean, that's the biggest, really, ag area in terms of intense ag, not so much vineyards and orchards and that. But it's really a huge production facility. I mean, Salinas Valley produces most of the United States,
lettuce. Yes. Well, this is the other thing glyphosate does, which is interesting. It interferes with the uptake of minerals from the soil, okay? So if we eat plants that have been sprayed with glyphosate, they don't have the minerals in that we would expect. Therefore, we're mineral deprived. The animals that are eating the feed are also then mineral deprived. So minerals are very important in how our bodies and cell function. And now we have a whole food system that doesn't have the requirement of minerals in it.
You've almost done me to silence, but I'll rant. Thank you. The minerals, I mean, not having minerals in them, mineral cofactors is how I would think of them in terms of supplements, are so powerful in what they do. They're the little tiny keys that make lots of things work and go together. So, it leads to, I think they say this in legal films, about goes to pattern, that when you start stripping the minerals out of our food, that's really bad. I mean, not only are we getting the weird chemistry and the pathogens, which I want to get back to pathogens, but you're removing the minerals that we need to make everything else in our systems work, affecting the methylation cascade and how everything's broken down. I mean, that is huge.
It is. That's why our bodies aren't working anymore. And, you know, we have all these problems.
Wow.
We are so nutrient depleted now. Subsequent generation now, we see it more and more. It's almost like, what is that book, Pottinger's Cats? You know, was back in the 30s where he did this experiment where he deprived his cats of the nutrients that they needed. And within a generation or two, they could barely produce. They were so sick, they had bone malformations, all these things. And then he did the reverse. He started to feed them nutrient-rich foods again, and it took four generations to recover. We are Pottinger's cats in human form, you know, and look where we are now. It's critical that we change what we're doing. Otherwise, you know, we're going to become extinct, I think.
There is somebody that I listened to that was, he was saying this in a very dark sense of humor, but he was really saying that he wasn't really worried about population control because at the rate we were going, we were going to be taking care of that ourselves by this very issue.
Exactly.
You know, that, oh, don't worry about it. Give us another generation or two. We're, you know, much less, you know, inclined toward getting, you know, men have elevated levels of estrogen. Women have depleted levels of their own estrogen. There's so many phytochemicals and so many things fighting our bodies and suppressing our immune system. I mean, it's like, it's, wow, we are, that's actually a great T-shirt. I am Pottinger's cat. You know, it's,
yeah.
It's a scary thing.
The other thing, Richard, you know this really well, too. You know, and I was talking to, you know, a relative the other day. You know, they expect to be sick in old age. They're planning on it. That's what Obamacare is. That's what the pharmaceutical companies are for. It's the mindset we've already accepted. I'm going to have all these symptoms and illnesses when I get old, so I need to plan for that time of life. I'm not planning for it. I'm going to be healthy as hell, you know. But, you know, why are we thinking that we need to plan an old age where we're sick and ill and in a hospital?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know either.
I'm with you. I feel the same way. You know, I came from a long line of, you know, ancestors who were, you know, like literally pioneers, and they didn't live as long, but, you know, they got eaten by things, or they got killed, or they got run over by a train, or they, you know, I mean, something bad.
My
but they
ancestors
shouldn't die
were
from cholesterol.
Lumberjacks.
Oh, well, there you have it. You completely outdo me then. You lumberjacks, my God.
Yeah, they
floated more
logs down the Mississippi River.
Wow. There's a song there somewhere. I know there is. But, I mean, yeah, I don't know why it's entered the consciousness that, as you said, that we are, you know, we age. You know, at some point, there are lots of comedians do this. At some point, and I hear other people talking on radio and seeing shows about this, at some point they talk about you reach an age where when you get up off the couch you make a noise. And I'm like, really? Why? Why? You know, my grandmother lived to be 106 and she didn't make a noise except when she was in a bad mood. You know, I mean, and it's just, we do seem to be moving the direction of, and I have somebody who just had this experience, 62, went in to see their doctor, had a fall and a hip fracture, which is a whole other, back to mineral depletions and mineral issues, vitamin D and all that. But, you know, she walked in, hadn't been to a doctor very much in her life because she'd always been healthy. And he was like, he was ready to put her on diuretics and blood pressure medications and this and that and everything. And she really, you know, she was healthy. Her blood pressure was in reason. Her cholesterol was slightly elevated based on their standards. And yet, it's just like there's a checklist. They see your age and they go, oh, well, you should be taking this and that and those.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
These and
you're
then,
ready
oh,
for
you
it
take
now.
Those for 2 years. You take those for 2 years and then you're going to have to start taking these because those have to counteract what those did. And wow.
Yeah. Well, we don't have to go down that road. I mean, that's what I'm telling people. I mean, I'm going to be 68 next month. I've never felt better in my entire life.
Yeah.
So.
It can happen. And really, I mean, you really did it with what people in white coats would call nutrition, what you and I would call other kind of white coats. I mean, you did it by cooking good, healthy, clean food. Really?
Yeah.
I mean, was there some other magic in there besides, you know, hard work and giving up sugar and that kind of thing? I mean, you really did it by eating well.
Well, it's amazing just what eating good food will do. It was such a simple thing. You know, no more pills, no more antidepressants or anything. It was just I started eating a certain way, and everything cleared up. What did Hippocrates say? You know, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. Well, it worked.
It's shocking. You know, eat good, clean food, and, wow, you're kind of healthy. How does that happen? A big fat lie.
I
big fat lie. That's
myself.
One.
You know, wow. I should have done this sooner.
Well, and especially, you know, yeah, you're a culinarian. For God's sakes, wouldn't you think you'd know? You know, or something.
I know. That's the thing. You'd think I'd know, right?
Well, but not
honestly,
necessarily.
Richard,
I mean,
I was a junkie. I would go to the store, you know, on a before a catering job. I would eat bear claws, things like that, donuts. I'm telling you, I really was a hypoglycemic sugar junkie.
Yeah.
You know, the heroin of food, that was me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
so,
yeah. Well, I mean, it's that high-stress job. I mean, being in
yeah.
the food world, in that sense of either catering or a chef or, well, most of the food world is pretty stressful, particularly in that
yeah.
high-end production thing. It's high stress, and at some point you've been up for 12 hours making, you know, cherry tomatoes stuffed with, you know, salmon foods for the thousandth time, and you think, oh, my God, I need something sweet, and I need it now. And, you know,
exactly.
I have in the old days
oh,
found
God.
Myself driving down the road toward a catering, you know, with, like, a Coke in one hand and a Reese's peanut butter cup in the other, just looking for the
oh,
buzz,
yes.
man, because you got to go set up for 200. Oh, yeah. No, it's tough. That's a whole other show. Someday I want to do an actual show of, like, what it's really like. It's not all just standing around beating egg whites in copper bowls. It's really, it is hard physical work. But you're
yeah.
right.
I was helping a friend pack the other day, and, you know, those little tiny muffin tin things? You
oh,
know,
yeah.
she had stacked of those. Do you ever remember making, you know, thousands of these little orange muffins that you put ham in and... you know, like pomegranate jelly
yes,
or
yes,
she says,
yes.
Do you think you'll ever make those again? I said, no, I don't think so.
I hope not. Yeah.
Catering
really will clear you up from all of those desires to think, oh, won't it be clever to stuff a snow pea with a feta mousse? You know, like, what are you thinking? Yes, it's clever,
oh,
and the
God.
First six people think they're delicious, but it takes you 20 hours to make 1,000 of them. I mean, it's, yeah, it's not a smart... So let's go back to, speaking of,
okay.
you know, disease, let's go back to the dysbiosis and talk about we use this term in both realms, good bacteria, bad bacteria, and talk a bit as you can about the, what that means in terms of, people hear bacteria and they think bad.
Listen,
that, you know, I think
our bodies are mostly bacteria. We are made up of bacteria, and they do a job all over our body, you know, different bacteria for different functions. And we need those. You know, there's bacteria in our eye that help clean up the, you know, our eyes. But in our gut, they help us digest and assimilate food. We need them, absolutely. The earth began on bacteria. We grew out of bacteria, so bacteria is here to stay, folks.
And how do we? Well, let's talk. You know, for a few minutes, we're rounding the bend. Let's talk for a few minutes about like the idea of most people hear the term probiotics and they think something that you take in a capsule, which I'm not opposed to. I think that's good as well. Good also, but there is a sort of a you know, they're now coming more and more. You see them at the farmers' markets as well. People who are talking about probiotic foods, like fermented foods, or your wonderful, fresh, or you know, those kinds.
Yeah, fermented foods are really good. And this is what some people don't understand that I recently learned too. Is when you eat a lot of cruciferous vegetables and you know. All that kind of stuff, a prebiotic situation starts to happen in your gut. It's like those foods actually start fermenting in your gut and act as a prebiotic, too. So, if you're eating a lot of roughage and all that stuff, your body will start utilizing that. And your good bacteria in there will use that. So, but a lot of us do need to boost with probiotics as well. I use a Nexobiotic that you can get on Amazon. That's a really good one.
And I'm a big fan of things like, if they're made well, you know, correctly, meaning, you know, not using chemicals, but actually made, like, you know, sauerkraut. Now,
yeah.
Most people kind of have, you know, as soon as you say sauerkraut to most people, they kind of squint and get a bad look on their face because the only thing they've ever had is that nasty stuff that comes out of a can that's been on a shelf for 5 years.
Yeah, I remember that. But you can get really good good brands now at the store. And a lot of people now, like we have a woman up here who teaches classes in fermented foods like making kombucha and kimchi and sauerkraut and things like that. Go take a class in it. It's fun.
Absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about kombucha? Do you know about kombucha?
Yeah, actually, there's a little restaurant here in town where you can buy the, we call them kombucha mushrooms. It's kind of, I don't know what exactly it is. It looks like a slimy mushroom.
Yeah.
And you make a tea with sugar in it, and then you introduce the mushroom on top of it, and it eats the sugar and turns it into acidic acid, but it creates a probiotic drink that then you can drink. It's fun to make at home. We've made it a lot of times. And it's better, actually, I think, to make it at home because it's kind of fun. Because a lot of the kombucha drinks that you buy in the store, unfortunately, are fortified with more sugar. So you really have to read the labels and watch that sugar thing on the contents.
Right, and the thing about the sugar when you actually make kombucha, the reason that you put sugar in there is to feed that slimy thing.
Yeah.
In its process, you're not putting sugar in to sweeten it as a beverage, like is Polly saying about people adding it so it's a sweet beverage. You are actually using that as a nutritive to the process of making the ferment. So when you drink real kombucha, it's not nearly as sweet as the stuff you get off the grocery
store. Oh, no, it's quite tart. And the first time I ever tasted it, I really didn't like it that much. It's kind of an acquired taste. It's sort of like drinking apple cider vinegar.
Yeah.
But it's really good for you, actually, to have some
that
every day.
It's really good, you know, all those things. And talk about, you have a recipe in your cookbook for, do you have a recipe in your book for making creme fraiche, or have we just talked about it?
I don't have a recipe for making creme fraiche, but it's really pretty easy, just to get a starter and then do it that way. You know, heat the cream and then add the starter and then just let it sit out for 24 hours, and then you have creme fraiche, and man, is that stuff good.
And talk a little bit, you and I are both drooling over talking about creme fraiche, but talk a little bit about what, you know, the applications of creme fraiche, you know, why it is, not only is it magic because it is probiotic active, but also how you would use creme fraiche. Where would you,
plop it on top of some berries. That's sort of my favorite way. Or, you know, you can use it in all the different ways that you use sour cream.
But it's actually, because it's fermented, it actually is positive pathogen active.
Yeah.
So it's a great whole food. It's a good fat. Do you make goat creme fraiche? Wow.
No, I haven't. But you know what? That sounds really good. I think I will do that.
I haven't. Till this moment. This is a live moment on radio, everybody. I haven't thought about that until just now.
That would be excellent. Because I love goat's milk and goat's cheese. I love that sort of tartness of it. Actually, when I make a cheesecake or something, I use goat cheese instead.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a whole other show, talking about recipes and food. We can do that anytime. I see we're coming to the end, and I should have people know where to find your book, Do you teach classes online? How do people know
about online.
What you do?
Not online. I teach paleo classes up here, and now I'm going to start designing another class that's more of a gut cleaning 6-week protocol that's a little more restrictive as far as the foods go, because a lot of people, like I have said, need to really clean up their gut more rapidly and move the toxins out. So I'm going to be designing that kind of a class soon.
That's great. And where did they find your book?
Okay, it's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's in many bookstores that order books from Simon & Schuster. So you can get it a lot of places. I think some Whole Foods stores have it. But Barnes & Noble website or Amazon.
And what's your website?
That's my email. Primal Cuisine, www.theprimalcuisine. Yeah.
.com. And there's great stuff here. I've been on the site, a bunch. It talks about the cookbook. It has this really great resource page. I could get lost in here for a long time because there's a lot of really, I like that photograph of the sheep on the hill. Out to eating grass, just like it's a regular thing to do. They don't know any better and we're just eating grass. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Notice the black sheep page. In the middle of all the white
sheep. Yeah, I like that. There's a black sheep in every family. I like it.
That's where I took the picture.
That's great. But this is a great, the resource page at the Primal Cuisine has a lot of really great information about, sustainability, sustainable eating, gardening, farmers and ranchers, the politics and policy of food and farming. Dun, dun, dun. Food
it's
and
more
water
than
watch,
just
my
a
favorite
cookbook.
People.
I really, it's a really good resource book.
It is. It has a lot of great, it does have really, this will be sort of my closing positive or toward closing shot with Polly, is that it's a really good cookbook and it's coming from somebody who knew how to cook professionally and then took what she knew and made recipes that are paleo and really damn good.
Thank you, Richard.
So that's the exciting part to me of, there are a lot of people out here are talking about, I've got a paleo diet cookbook or blah, 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 rah, rah, rah. But they didn't, not that you, I don't mean that you have to cook professionally. I just mean that if you cook professionally and you care about food to produce a recipe that other people can use and you have probably, made something like that a bazillion times, is really a big benefit to me. I like people who make cookbooks who have actually done it.
Thank you.
No, that's a really
great
thing.
Well, it was a lot of fun, I have to say. It was a great career to have and love cooking. I still love it, so I think it came through in the book.
It did, definitely. And here's a great page, the one that's for food for thought, and I love the, the fat family here with the olive oil and the Kerrygold and the coconut oil and the sesame oil and an oil that I can't read back there, and I'm suspecting that's ghee. This is really the primalcuisine.com website is filled with lots of great information.
Yeah, the website
about,
is great too. Take
it's
a look
not just
around
about, it's
because
not just
it has
about
a lot
the cookbook.
Of good information on it.
It has a lot of great information. I'm very pro, all of this. So thank you ever so much, Polly. I knew it was going to be fun.
Thank you, Richard.
And
thank
it was
you so much.
Great again. Sometime we'll actually talk about food.
let's have another talk sometime this summer, maybe.
Absolutely, we will. All right. Thanks, everybody. Thank you again, Polly. We'll talk again soon. Everybody have a great week. For those of you back at conference, party down. We'll talk soon. Bye-bye.